Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. In September, the world's oldest woman, Kamado Hongo, turned 115 years old in Japan. Demographers also announced recently that the average American could expect to live 77 years. That's 30 years longer than the 47 years we could expect in 1900. Most of us are delighted by the thought we have even odds of making it to 77, and we hope that we can make it past 100. Sadly, some of America's leading bioethicists think that wanting to live as long as Ms. Hongo is wrong. Their complaint is not so much with reasons that people have lived a long time up till now, but with the way that they might live longer in the future. There have been two big contributors to longer lives in the 20th century, public health and medical technology. Of these, public health has made the much larger contribution thus far by reducing deaths from infectious diseases and poor health habits. The countries with the longest life expectancies are those with the strongest public health systems, Social Democratic Northern Europe and Canada. More importantly, people in countries with strong public health systems have longer healthy lives, not just longer periods of disability at the end of life. According to the World Health Organization, the average citizen of the United States, with 40 million uninsured and a weak public health system, can expect 2 to 3 fewer years of healthy, disability-free life. Where Americans excel is with medical technology, the second source of longevity. If you can make it to 75 in America, you have a better chance of making it to 85 than anywhere else in the world. Public health is reaching the limits of its effectiveness in extending life in the industrialized world. Even after eliminating infectious diseases, accidents, and preventable cancers, strokes, and heart disease, the ravages of the aging process will itself keep most people from their 100th birthday. Life extension in the 21st century will mostly come from biotechnology. Fortunately, there are many therapeutic methods being explored to stop and even reverse the aging process. We are not far from a drug or genetic therapy that can slow down or turn off aging altogether. For instance, dozens of researchers are examining the changes in animals that cause them to live 50% longer when their calorie consumption is halved. Within 10 years, drugs that mimic the effect of calorie reduction should be available. Once national health systems begin to make these therapies available to all their citizens, costs will fall. Use can spread globally, and life expectancies will surge ahead in the developed and developing world. Some worry that life extension medicine will make the alleged overpopulation problem worse. But the way to address population constraints is not by encouraging people to die. Rather, we need to empower women through access to education, employment, contraception, and abortion. We need to distribute wealth more equitably and use biotechnology carefully to increase agricultural yields. Telling people that it is their duty to die should be the last resort. Some powerful bioethicists, however, are working hard to champion death and fight life extension. Leon Cass, the chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, wants to, quote, make the case for the virtues of mortality, unquote. In that, he is joined by his fellow council member Francis Fukuyama, who argues against life extension medicine in his book Our Post-Human Future. Cass, Fukuyama, and other advocates of a natural lifespan argue that longer lives will have many disastrous consequences in addition to overpopulation. Societies will become rigid, ruled by authoritarian gerontocracies. Lecherous old people will pine for the affections of the population of the nubile young. The shrinking pool of young workers will come to hate supporting their retired great-grandparents. No doubt, society will change and adapt, just as it did as the average life expectancy rose from 47 to 77 in the 20th century. But if the growing number of elderly are such a threat to the social order, why stop at forbidding life extension medicine? Why not forbid the elderly medical care altogether? The deathists have no good answer. The Cass-Fukuyama arguments for death are lovely gothic poetry, odes to the grim reaper worthy of morbid 19-year-old poets. The scary part is that they are now attempting to shape U.S. health policy. Fortunately, they are fighting a doomed rearguard action. Scientific progress will march on, and as practical benefits are offered, they will win public support. A long, healthy life is a blessing, not a curse. The world is a big place with lots of things to learn, lots of people to meet, lots of books to read and projects to work on. Few will be convinced to fall on their sword or allow their parents and friends to die in the service of the abstract virtues of death. Our great-grandchildren will inevitably look back in sadness that we had such a short time to know this world. But if we resist the technology-bashing rhetoric of the pro-death camp, it may give us and our children a couple more decades in what promises to be a very interesting century. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'm speaking with Dr. Stanley Shostak, who presents a pretty radical idea about how to achieve life extension. Dr. Shostak is an associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the previous author of Death of Life, Legacy of Molecular Biology, Evolution of Sameness and Difference, and now most recently, Becoming Immortal, Combining Cloning and Stem Cell Therapy. Welcome, Dr. Shostak.
Thank you, Jay.
Your most recent book is about the connections between cloning and stem cells and longevity. But this is the first time you've actually addressed the topic of longevity. How did you come to this, an interest in how these new therapies and technologies might address longevity?
I'm not interested in longevity. I'm interested in immortality. I'm not interested in prolonging life. I'm interested in having a totally different type of life. Everything centered on life as being something that ended. And I had to worry and think about what was wrong with that view. When we talk about evolution, we talk about generations following generations, why was there no way in which a generation could continue?
But did that arise out of the previous research that you've been doing? Was there some connection between the embryologic research that you had conducted and this current endeavor?
Actually, you're right there. So many embryos die. As Lewis Wolpert says, it's not birth or marriage that's the most important event in your life. It's gastrulation, the period in early development when the germ layers begin to form, when cells begin to move. It seems as though 80% of the embryos don't get beyond that. It struck me that we don't have a concept that accounts for this early death. And I wanted to find what was wrong with our concepts that eliminated so much.
Now, let me just throw out the end, and we'll start backwards from the end, kind of teleological approach to an interview. The conclusion of your book appears to be that if we could genetically engineer a clone of ourselves so that it stayed at the blastocyst stage, which has pluripotent cells and generates pluripotent stem cells, and introduce that as a permanent component of our own bodies, and eliminate our own germline cells so that we were no longer, so that we were prepubescent, permanently prepubescent, that in that state we could perpetually regenerate our own bodies and never die. Is that the conclusion of your book?
That's very well put. Yeah, I think that's a conclusion you could fairly draw from my book. But the object of the book is to investigate all of the issues that surround that conclusion. I don't think the conclusion is half as interesting as the issues that it raises.
I think that's probably right, and that's the direction I wanted to go, because it seems like, you know, if the other things that lead you to that conclusion are correct, there may be many other possible conclusions, which would also take us towards immortality or extended longevity, however you want to look at it. So let's start with the evidence that aging is a matter of the obsolescence of our body's ability to replenish itself with stem cells. This seems to be one of your central arguments, that if we could have a more perpetual source of pluripotent stem cells populating our body, circulating in our body, that it would overcome the ravages of aging. Why do you think that, and is there clinical evidence for that?
Well, clinical evidence, I don't think I can provide, but I just got a copy of Advances in Cell Aging and Gerontology, Volume 9. It's on stem cells. The subtitle is A Cellular Fountain of Youth, and half of the articles in it have aging in the title, hematopoietic stem cells and aging, thymus and aging. So I think that what I suggested in Becoming Immortal is almost a mainstream idea. I don't know that every tissue has stem cells, and I think it would be important to find out. I think some tissues might have cells that divide, but are not stem cells, that they're really quite restricted to just those providing cells for those tissues and have no greater potential. But certainly, if life is maintained by stem cells, then yes, we should be able to maintain life indefinitely by having an endless source of stem cells.
So aging-related diseases such as, we can understand how this might be the case with aging-related diseases such as a stroke, but wouldn't our body become filled up with the detritus of failed tissue? And even though new tissue, new clones, stem cells were filling in around the gaps, it wouldn't necessarily flush out all the bad stuff.
No, I think our bodies are much more inventive of ways of removing waste than we are. We are not limited to surface cells for removing waste. Of course, the skin is constantly throwing off dead cells, and the intestine is constantly throwing off dead cells. Both of these are surface organs. Blood is constantly throwing off dead cells as well through the action of the spleen and liver. And we seem to be very creative about disposing of waste. I don't think that would be a problem.
So if we had this constant source of stem cells, why wouldn't we, for instance, just from an aesthetic point of view, or to overcome people's resistance to your other endpoint idea, why wouldn't we want to just introduce these on a regular basis, say through transfusions or some other kind of implant than the one you suggest?
I think my gut reaction is that you are not considering history or time or memory adequately. I think the stem cells need the experience of the organism. They have to be able to read it, and they acquire that experience during exposure to the organism. My guess is that we can't start anew every year or so, that the stem cells require a longer presence and experience with the body.
So there's a certain amount of entrainment, even though these are, what you're proposing, are our need for blastocyst stage pluripotent cells, which have no, because there's some evidence now that the degree of differentiation that takes place later, so that there, we have a source of, for instance, of bone marrow stem cells that provide blood, new blood, and neural stem cells, but there might not be as much interchangeability between those as we had thought. So your proposal is that we need these pluripotent stem cells at the beginning, but even so, you're suggesting that by having them in the body, there's a certain amount of entrainment to the body, to understanding what is necessary for the body, or some kind of communication between that source and, because I guess what I'm saying is that there isn't that kind of communication now. The blastocyst is complete in and of itself, and the communication that we know of occurs between the relatively differentiated adult stem cells and the body.
Well, I am certainly talking about creating a new organ, and my theory, if that's not too strong a word, of devolution, which suggests that organs as well as tissues have devolved through a variety of processes, including parasitism, that we must consider that evolution has not been linear, that organs have been formed by the fusion of tissues or of even other organisms. And likewise, tissues that were have split and become other things. I don't think that this linear view of life that we gather through Darwinism is going to be adequate for the complexities of life as I see it.
You've also taken a look, I'm sure, at the other proposals for life extension and for immortality that other writers have talked about, proposals such as nanotechnological enhancements of the body, a cryonic suspension, which, of course, just puts off the question of how we're going to achieve life extension, genetic engineering of the body. Your proposal, by the way, would require probably some genetic engineering, wouldn't it? The genetic engineering of the cloned blastocyst would, in order to prevent it from developing further into a complete being.
I'm not sure how much engineering would be required. The genetics will probably require some attention. I'm for doing the experiment. I'm for putting some blastocysts into embryos and seeing how they handle it and learning what the problems are from the empirical result.
Uh-huh. Are you engaged in that kind of experimentation with animal models now?
No, I'm a theorist.
Oh. Are you? Has anyone expressed an interest in performing these experiments?
No.
Uh-huh. Are you looking for somebody to do that?
Of course, I'd be very happy.
Yeah.
If someone were to start doing this. My guess is that it's inevitable that it's going to happen, and I'm not looking for credit. These ideas are afloat. They're not mine. They didn't come out of my head. They come out of the community of ideas.
Well, you've certainly given them a novel expression. It's not one that we've seen discussed very widely.
That's my problem.
Yeah. How about the juvenilization end of this? I'm sure this is what gives most people the most pause. It doesn't seem like that this would be a therapy that very many people would choose for themselves or their children, barring some unforeseen, you know, disaster. That idea of permanent prepubescent state as a trade-off for immortality. Now, I you know personally, I think immortality is pretty important, and I can foresee doing a lot of things to my body. But it just seems like this is, most people would say, hey, isn't there some other way other than having my testicles or my ovaries removed and never being a fertile being?
Well, sex is a time bomb. You can't have it both ways. Either the sex cells are going to be your immortality via new generations, or the stem cells are going to be your immortality via continuous recirculation in the organism. The kind of organism that I'm talking about, the kind of human being that will be immortal, won't be like you. It's now, I can imagine that it'll be possible to work you down, work you back to a prepubescent state, but I don't think that's the way it'll happen. My guess is that experimentation with animals will produce immortal animals, and as soon as that's done, there'll be people who will say, well, what about us? I disagree with you also on the attitude toward sexuality. As the human population is aging, and Fukuyama and others have certainly given overwhelming evidence, statistical evidence, that we are aging, the interest in sex is going to diminish. This concentrated effort, interest in sexuality, my guess is, will disappear as half of the population becomes over 60. And so it won't be as large an obstacle to immortalization as it is now when the population is relatively young.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Stanley Shostak, with the author of Becoming Immortal, Combining Cloning and Stem Cell Therapy. And Dr. Shostak, you're also working on another book called The Illogic of Life. Can you tell us a little bit about the theme of that?
The theme of that is chaos. I'm thinking of chaos as the missing link, the thing which will bring my views of life as far from equilibrium and an attractor state closer to the image that most people seem to have of life as being mechanical and written in DNA and available for us to mess around with. I think that there's a missing dimension in this mechanistic and mechanical view of life, which chaos theory can supply. But chaos theory is not a seat of logic in my mind. It depends on unpredictability, and that is something that we don't know how to think about yet. That's why I call the book The Illogic of Life.
Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Shostak.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
I wanted to read today an article by Ron Bailey, my favorite technology writer. He writes for Reason magazine, reason.com. And this article is published in reason.com, Forever Young, The New Scientific Search for Immortality. As Woody Allen put it, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying. Modern biomedical researchers, in the quest for the equivalent of Gilgamesh's waterweed, have made great progress in unraveling the mystery of aging. Physical immortality may not be in the immediate offing, but the day may come when death is radically postponed, if not fully optional. The barriers to this goal are not just biological, but political. Believe it or not, some of our most influential contemporary intellectuals are opposed to the idea of long, healthy lives. Quote, "The finitude of human life is a blessing for every individual, whether he knows it or not," wrote Leon Cass, the president's favorite bioethicist, in the May 2001 issue of First Things. Francis Fukuyama warns in his new book, Our Post-Human Future, that young geezers will, quote, "refuse to get out of the way, not just of their children, but their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren," unquote. And then there's Daniel Callahan, co-founder of the Hastings Center, the nation's leading bioethics think tank. Quote, "There is no known social good coming from the conquest of death," he declared at a March 2000 conference on aging and life extension. He added, quote, "The worst possible way to resolve this issue is to leave it up to individual choice," unquote. On the scientific front, though, there's good reason for optimism. Quote, "The prospects of dramatically increasing human longevity are excellent," unquote, declares Stephen Alsted, a biologist at the University of Idaho. Quote, "Don't expect them tomorrow, but there will be major advances within the next 50 years, unquote. Alsted, author of the 1997 book Why We Age, What Science is Discovering About the Body's Journey Through Life, expects 20 to 40-year jumps in longevity to occur later in this century. I think that's conservative. "We see ourselves on the cusp of the second longevity revolution," agrees Jay Olshansky, a demographer at the University of Chicago and the author of The Quest for Immortality, 2001. "Scientists are on the verge of discovering major secrets of aging. The first longevity revolution occurred in the early 20th century as infant mortality declined and infectious diseases were conquered. As a result, more young people now enjoy the opportunity to become old. The next longevity revolution, by contrast, will actually postpone old age." Of the two researchers, Olshansky can be considered the pessimist. He bet Alsted $500 million that there will be no 150-year-old person alive and in fairly good shape in 2150. The bet was set up as a trust fund, endowed by $150 from each scientist. Given the math behind compound interest, the winner's heirs will get the $500 million payout on January 1, 2150. Love and death. Woody Allen might appreciate the science of longevity as well as the results. Sex and death, it turns out, are intrinsically intertwined. "It doesn't pay to have a body that will last forever, notes Alsted. "Evolution only cares about reproduction. Every body harbors a line of immortal cells, the germ cells that produce eggs and sperm. Germ cells migrate from body to body down the millennium, disposing of their worn-out carriers as they move on. Once your ovaries or testes are done with you, they couldn't care less whether you live. Here, then, is the definitive answer to the eternal question, which came first, the chicken or the egg?" Well, the egg did. The chicken is merely an egg's way of making more eggs. "In the case of human beings, evolution has selected for a set of genes that keep our bodies in pretty good shape, long enough to mature sexually, produce progeny, and raise those progeny to sexual maturity. Time elapsed about 40 years. The evolutionary insight here is that if a body invests a lot of energy in repairing itself, it will reduce the amount that it can devote to reproduction. That may be good for individual bodies, but your germ cells have no interest in keeping you forever young. The UCLA biologist Michael Rose firmly established the evolutionary connection between sex and death by breeding fruit flies. Rose selected only those flies that reproduced late in life and bred them with one another. The longer it took the insects to reproduce, the longer they lived. Rose now has flies that live 130 days instead of the usual 40. The connection was further bolstered this January by Cynthia Kenyon, a biologist at the University of California in San Francisco. Kenyon reported that she could double the lifespans of nematode worms by removing their germline stem cells, the cells that produce sperm and egg. Then there's Lawrence Donauer's recent research at Baylor Medical College. Donauer has found that the genes that are helpful in guaranteeing a robust youth are harmful in the long run. The tumor-suppressing P53 gene keeps us from developing cancers in early life, but at the cost of stimulating our immune systems to destroy over time the reserve of rapidly dividing stem cells that replenish our tissues. As our stem cells are killed off, our tissues deteriorate. The result of this antagonistic pleiotropy is aging. Another example of antagonistic pleiotropy was discovered by the biologist Leonard Hayflick in 1961. Hayflick, now at UC San Francisco, found that human cells in vitro would divide only 50 to 80 times, then stop. For a while, some researchers thought this Hayflick limit might be the key to aging. What it appears to be is an evolved mechanism to prevent cancer. Cancer is the uncontrolled proliferation of cells, and as cells divide, they often accumulate errors that predispose them to becoming cancerous. If there is a limit on the number of times a cell can divide, such a limit prevents cells from eventually mutating into cancer cells. How do cells know when to stop? Through telomeres, caps composed of repetitive DNA sequences at the end of the chromosomes. These function somewhat like the aglets on the end of shoelaces that keep them from unraveling. Through a peculiarity in DNA replication, each time a cell divides, its daughter cells lose a tiny bit of their telomeres. Once the telomeres are gone, the cell stops dividing and becomes senescent. Two types of cells do not suffer this problem. One is the germ cells that are the progenitors of sperm and egg. Their telomeres are restored by an enzyme called telomerase, making them essentially immortal. The other group is cancer cells. They can divide without limit, which is what makes them so deadly. I've been reading from an article called Forever Young, The New Scientific Search for Immortality, written by Ron Bailey in Reason Magazine Online, August 2002. And you can finish the second half of the article there. Go to reason.com and do a search on Ron Bailey or the article Forever Young. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.